Hi everybody, hope you're well. This is Jim Carr saying hello and welcome you to the latest Bantercast, the weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. At Banter, we put on events in spaces and venues of all shapes and sizes up and down the country, and we invite a range of interesting people to come along to tell stories, talk about their lives and discuss various topics and themes. We record what happens in the room and then we podcast results. Paul Howard is the man who has brought us the trials, tribulations and triumphs of Russell Carl Kelly, but it was another dude who was on his mind when he joined us as other voices in Dingle recently. Paul was in town to talk about his new book, I Read the News Today, Oh Boy, about the life and times of Tara Brown, the inspiration behind the Beatles' A Day in the Life. It's a fascinating tale about a colourful character who lived quite a life. Hi folks, welcome back to Banter here at Foxy John's. Would you please welcome Paul Howard.
Thank you. Thanks.
A snappy dresser, a friend of the Stones, a Vogue model, a husband and father of two, a racing car driver, the heir to a £1 million fortune, the owner of a psychedelically coloured AC Cobra, the man who introduced Paul McCartney to LSD, and the owner of a clothes store on the King's Road called Dandy Fashions. This Tara Brown guy, not you, I'm sorry, if people in the room thought that was you.
Yeah,
this
the snappy dresser kind of, you know.
Yeah, just those listening on the podcast, Paul's currently rocking a sort of a brown camel sort of charcoal sports coat. That'd be right?
It'd be fair enough. Yeah. I thought, you know, I've got to be there was a crowd here and I thought, well, I've got to wear something where I'll be recognised coming in, that they'll know that I should be the frontier, you know, so yeah.
Okay. Let's start with I Read the News Today, Oh Boy, right? Mm. The book you've written about Tara Brown. Would it be fair to say this was a passion project?
Yeah, I mean, I it's a kind of lifetime project in the sense that I first heard about Tara Brown when I was a kid. Like I've loved the Beatles all my life. My father and mother moved to England from Ireland in the 60s. And so they lived in swinging London. They were there at that time. And the music in our house growing up was always, that was the soundtrack of our Sunday lunchtimes, was music, the 60s music, not just the Beatles, but Herman's Hermits, the Kinks, the Who. This was the music we listened to. So I grew up oddly nostalgic for an era that I didn't live through. And I think a lot of people are like that as well.
I think so. I mean, that's a current meme as well. Yeah. With people, younger people today. I mean, they're very nostalgic for an 80s or a 90s that they don't remember or never lived.
Yeah, I see 13-year-old kids walking around with Nirvana T-shirts and I feel like saying, you weren't there. But, I'm the same with the 60s. I wasn't there, but I understood its significance. I knew that this was, you know, culturally, musically, sociologically, in so many ways, a renaissance, and it's still being felt today. You know, in so many ways, like the protest movement, things like that. I was well aware that this was a hugely significant period, especially that period in London between 1962, late 62, early 63, and the summer of 1967 when Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club came out, that this was a really, really special time. That's the 60s to me. Mm. And that particular song, my dad had the original Sgt. Pepper's, and what drew me to it as a child was the fact that there was this card inside and it had this cut out moustache and these epaulettes that you could cut out and put on, and I wasn't allowed to cut them out. And I think being forbidden from touching this card was what drew me again and again to the album. And I listened to it, and I'll never forget that moment of dropping the needle on that particular song, A Day in the Life, which is the song that closes the album. Mm. And hearing those opening lines, I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grade. And I think, like a lot of people, I mean, the song is really, the opening of the song, that scene, it's really a bunch of rubberneckers who are looking at this car accident and wondering who this guy is, this young man who's died at the wheel of this car. And John Lennon, in writing that, kind of invites us all to rubberneck with him. Mm. And we're all you're listening to the song and you're thinking, you know, who is he? I've seen his face before. Nobody's really sure if he's from the House of Lords. And I think, you know, that scene it stayed in my head, and I always wondered who he was. And then I think when I was probably about 17 or 18, I found out that he was a real person, that John Lennon had read the Daily Mail as he often did, you know, when John Lennon needed inspiration. And he certainly did around that time when they were making Sgt. Pepper, because Paul McCartney was on a roll creatively. And John Lennon was quite feeling quite bereft in an artistic sense. He was taking huge amounts of LSD at that time. He was living this really, really dull suburban life with a wife and kid in Weybridge, while Paul McCartney was kind of gadding about London. He was, you know, going to, you know, happenings and to art gallery openings, and he was becoming, you know, just interested in the avant-garde. So Paul McCartney was much more switched on to what was actually happening in London, and John Lennon wasn't. So when they came to write the songs for Sgt. Pepper, Paul McCartney had this idea that it was going to be songs inspired by their northern childhoods. And they would all, so it was a nostalgic record, really. And John Lennon wrote Strawberry Fields Forever, and he felt that he'd shot his bolt creatively with Strawberry Fields Forever. He didn't think he had anything left in him. And in January 1967, he sat down at the piano and opened up the newspaper, which is the Daily Mail. And on page three was a news report, which was headlined Guinness Air Babies to Stay with Grandmother. And it was a news report into the custody case, which was being fought between Tara's widow, who was this sort of mini-skirted 22-year-old, and his mother, who was this, you know, very, very glamorous Guinness brewery heiress who had a big fur coat. And so it was two worlds clashing. And I don't think it was an accident that John Lennon fixed upon that particular report. I think he realized this was very significant, and that Tara had, you know, was very, very important in the context of the 60s.
Right. I mean, you've made the point in various interviews that, like, you know, that what Tara represented was, I suppose, like, you know, this age of enlightenment, let's call it that, I mean, of the 60s, like, where everything was possible, where also the situations that you just described, where the aristocracy, like, rubbed shoulders with kind of, like, I mean, the working class kids who were on the make, who were on the kind of up, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I suppose, you know, do you think, you know, when Lennon wrote that song, like, did he know much about Tara Brown at that stage?
He'd been in his house. I mean, Tara's house... He had a muse in Belgravia, and it was a scene for a kind of after the clubs, people would go back there, and it became part of the scene. So clubs
a bit like Benner's Hotel.
Yeah, a little bit like Benner's. Yeah. So, you know, there was clubs in London like, you know, the Ad Lib and the Scotch and St. James, where the Rolling Stones would hang out. And, you know, in those days before, you know, super, super fandom, this is sort of 63, 64, the bands used to just go to the bars, you know, and they would, and you know, we kind of forget it here because we're in Ireland, and that kind of still happens. You know, you come to Dingle and you might see Bono or something, you know, but in America and in England at that time, it was still happening. Later on, it stopped happening, that the bands kind of put distance between themselves and their fandom. But so Tara was hanging out in the Ad Lib and the Scotch and St. James. And afterwards, they would all gravitate back to his muse in Belgravia. And, you know, on any one night, because he was a very nice guy, you know, he's a very sort of gentle character, and very, very open to people and very secure in himself, which is why I think bands like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles became close to him, because he wasn't trying to ride their trip. Mm-hmm. He had his own standing. He was very comfortable in his own skin. He had his own money. And they would go back to this house in Belgravia and they would, you know, smoke pot. And they would take acid and they would listen to Pet Sounds or Revolver. And it was a happy stew of everybody who was anybody in swinging London. So that meant, you know, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, as well as that, you know, members of the aristocracy, members of the House of Lords, the Cray twins, you know, you could have criminals, aristocratic black sheep. Absolutely anybody would be back in the muse. Tara's widow, Nikki, said to me that, you know, she would wake up in the morning and she would just, the living room was just strewn with bodies, and she would sort of turn them over. And she said, you never knew who was going to be a Beatle, who was going to be a Rolling Stone, and, you know, who was going to be a member of the Crays or the Richardson's gang. It was just absolutely everybody. So that was a microcosm, really, of what was happening in swinging London. It was this, you know, social barriers. I mean, especially in London, and Lennon was very, very conscious of this. the social stratification of British society was hugely important. And you had this, you know, centuries old ritual of coming out, where you know, girls who got to sort of 17, 18 years of age, they'd finish school, they went to finishing school, maybe in Paris, and then they came back to London and they did a series of balls at which they would hopefully meet the person they would get married to and spend the rest of their life with. Invariably, they spent about 3 years with them and maybe had a couple of kids and then moved on to the next marriage. But that was kind of how society was organized in Britain in those days.
Yeah. Let's go back a little bit, because I mean, like, you know, if you've got this dude here, this connector, Tara Brown, is like, I mean, like, you know, he's bringing all these different worlds together. What's in his background to suggest this was going to happen? You know, when he was growing up, what was in the background to suggest this would be his likely destination?
Yeah, it's a good question, because his background, this was his background essentially, and it all comes back to his mother, Una Guinness. Una, she wasn't like other aristocrats, you know, she wasn't like the British aristocrat. She was an Irish aristocrat, and she didn't have any time for horsey, you know, the horsey set. You know, she didn't like those aristocrats who could only talk about horses or the distance between them and the royal family, which is what so many aristocrats were obsessed with. She liked bohemians and she liked artists, and her first two husbands were the horsey set. And she married her first husband. She married him at 19. She met him at one of these debutante balls, danced twice together. He proposed to her and they got married. And that was how it happened. And then sort of 4 or 5 years later, she realized he realized that was a mistake, and he moved on to somebody else. And she moved on to somebody else who happened to be Tara's father, who was Lord Oranmore and Brown. And again, Irish aristocracy. And That marriage broke up, and that was kind of, Tara was about 5 years of age then, and that was really where the story starts of this mixing thing, because Una took her two children, Gareth, Tara's brother, who is Gareth Brown, the patron of Irish music, and she took them to Lugalaw in Wicklow. And I don't know how many people have ever seen Lugalaw or know what it looks like. It's like a wedding cake. It's a house. To me, it looks like a castle because I'm middle class. But I mean, I'm told it's actually a house. But it looks like it's a whitewashed castle at the bottom of a valley in Wicklow. It really is the most spectacular thing, spectacular house I've ever seen in my life. And there she set up this kind of literary salon where she entertained all these bohemian friends. And so Una was about 40, I think she was 40 at that stage. And Tara was 5 years old. And that's really where that story starts. So Tara grew up in a home where every weekend the guests are Lucian Freud, Brendan Behan, Cyril Connolly, Caroline Blackwood, John Huston. You know, really, really clever, artistic, very, very liberated people. And this, you got to remember, this is in the middle of De Valera's Ireland. Like, this is 1950s Ireland, where Dev and John Charles McQuaid held sway. And right in the middle of this Ireland, you've got this oasis where all these bohemians hang out together. And outrageous things happened in that house. And Una was the centre of it, and she was the puppet master. And she invited people to the house. She had this very Oscar Wilde type wicked sense of humor and wicked sense of what would entertain her. So she would organize the placings at dinner in a particular way that would cause sparks. So she would sit Brendan Behan between, as she did on one occasion, between two unionist ladies who he enraged them and they enraged him, and there was a huge fight. You know, if the worst crime you could commit at Lugalaw was to be boring. And if you were boring, you weren't asked back. But if you were involved in an incident where somebody stormed out or somebody threatened somebody else with a butter knife, you were asked back. It was considered a huge success. But they were great. They were great mixing occasions. And it's interesting. Gareth still, to this day, Mary and I, my wife, we go to Lugalaw from time to time. We're invited to dinner there. And they still have that thing of mixing people, you know. And you just never know when you go to Lugalaw who's going to be there. And I've had days there when you could have Pierce Brosnan, you could have the ambassador to the Estonian ambassador to Ireland, and some travellers who Gareth met in the Roundwood Inn the previous Wednesday, and one of them mentioned he could play the Illan pipes. And that's the day. Yeah. And you look in the corner and sometimes you catch Gareth seeing you talking to somebody you didn't know before you got there, and he smiles. So that's where they're coming from. You know, the Guinnesses were they're very inclusive,
yeah,
very hospitable. And Una, sort of before this life, when Una was in her teens and her 20s, she was part of a group called in London who were called the Bright Young Things. And they were, so the Bright Young People or the Bright Young Things, they were a set who were involved in, you know, this sort of high energy, you probably describe it, high octane squealing fun. That's the best way to describe them. They would do stunts. They had tons and tons of money and they just nothing to do. It was between the wars, so they didn't have a war to fight. And it was like the end of the First World War suddenly unleashed this great, you know, sense of fun on these young people. They said all the stress of the war is gone and they didn't take anything seriously.
Yeah.
And for instance, Tara's mother had a cousin who's called Kenelm Lee Guinness. And one day, front page of the Daily Mail, he got 10,000 aluminium cans and he lined them up the mall in outside Buckingham Palace and he drove a steamroller over them. And they asked him why he did that. And he said, "Why must you ask why? I like the sound." And in a way, that's a pre-echo of what later happened in the 60s, you know, because the 60s really was a democratization of what had happened in the 30s, the late 20s and the 30s, you know, that kind of that fun at all costs thing, you know, that yeah, suddenly the fun that people like Tara's mother had was democratized. Everybody could enjoy it.
Yeah. Given all the research you've done into Tara, you know, Paul, I mean, given the fact you go up to Lugala on a regular basis, what do you think Gareth's take is and that set's take is on how things are today? Because, I mean, when you talk there about that sense of fun, that sense of adventure, I mean, I'm sure there's people in the room kind of thinking like, okay, there are similarities today, but not to the same extent.
Yeah. Yeah, but at the same time, I think there is greater mobility between the classes today than there was in the 30s, for instance. You know, I'm not sure whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I mean, there's certainly an enormous middle class now that wasn't there then. There was a lower class, there was a small middle class, and an upper class, but those aristocrats, you know, people like Gareth, they're a dying breed, you know, that after the war, it was necessary to find somebody to pay for the war. So they taxed the aristocracy essentially out of existence. And then, you know, with Tony Blair, changed the rules so that hereditary peerages were abolished. So like Gareth's father, for instance, Tara's father lived till he was 102. And after Tony Blair essentially abolished his seat, he just said, you know, that's it, that's all from me, tootle-pip, and died the following year, you know. So they are a dying breed, you know, and I don't know how Gareth feels about you know, that side of things today, but I suspect he feels it's a lot duller than it was.
Yeah.
Than it was in those days.
Well, it strikes me it does, because I mean, so in the book as well, you went down to Mayo the house in Mayo as well.
Yeah.
And like, you know, it just struck me that particular time that you were chronicling, you know, God, it was great fun, you know. It just struck me that like anything can go, and like a lot of the seeds of what happened in the 60s, you could see was coming out of that kind of like that Anglo-Irish set, what they were doing.
Yeah, yeah, especially Castle McGarrett. I mean, Castle McGarrett is, I mean, today it's essentially derelict. I mean, it's in probably better nick than a derelict house, but it will get there eventually because nobody's in it. And those houses, they need to be, you know, if you live in one of those houses, you have to be constantly tipping away at it. You know, when Lord Oranmore lived in Castle McGarrett, he had a full-time slater and he was a full-time employee whose job it was just to walk around the roof all day putting slates back that had fallen off. So that kind of Ireland is that, you know, that those old houses have fallen into disrepair now. The ones that haven't become hotels, they're dying. But back in those days, they were the start of this thing. You know, they were the start. I mean, you know, Castle McGarrett was buzzing at the. It was the era of the great Edwardian house party, where you had all these royals coming from all over Europe to shoot woodcock and snipe and to hunt, you know. And so it was an amazing time, yeah. but a time that's gone now, you know. It's never coming back again. And what's interesting, I think, in the context of the 60s is those big old houses that the formerly rich could no longer afford to live in, they suddenly, the only people who could actually afford to buy them were the new aristocracy of rock and roll, you know. So you had Brian Jones, John Lennon, Mick Jagger, Keith Richards living in these enormous ancient pads, you know, that an aristocrat had previously owned, which I think is an interesting twist on what happened in the 60s, you know, that they were the power and the glory. Mike McCartney, Paul McCartney's brother, I interviewed him for the book, and Paul and Mike were both good friends of Tara's, and Mike was kind of reminiscing about the time before, you know, in sort of the early 60s, 62, 63, before the Beatles became big. And he said, if you went to London and you had a regional accent, meaning if you were from Liverpool, Manchester, Birmingham, Glasgow, or even Dublin, people would turn their backs on you in polite company, because you were of no use to them. That's how he described it to me. You know, they would say, oh, where are you from? And they say, I'm from Liverpool. And they go, oh, Tristan, what were you saying? And they would physically turn their back on you. And he said, suddenly, because of the Beatles, there was a few other factors, I think, as well. You know, the BBC had started to use regional newsreaders with a Yorkshire accent, you know. And then there'd been the sort of kitchen sink dramas of the late 1950s as well, that kind of introduced a little bit of, I suppose it kind of made working class life seem a little bit more cool than it had. But it was really the Beatles, you know, that suddenly it became almost essential to be from the north of England rather than from London. It was the thing. So that all feeds into what happened in the 60s. But Tara was central to it in that he was always the guy in the middle. He was often the guy, not always. He was often the guy in the middle saying, you know, Princess Margaret, have you met Mick Jagger?
Yeah.
You know, because these two, you know, social groups who are coming together for the first time, it doesn't just happen, you know. There has to be some people on that side of the room looking awkward and some people on this side of the room. In fact, Anita Pallenberg in the book says it was exactly that. She said you would go to the Ad Lib and she said there were all these, you know, incredibly posh aristocrat guys standing on that side of the room and girls who kind of looked like they were at a debutante dance waiting to be asked up. And then she said you had all these kind of reprobates, you know, like Keith Richards and Brian Jones and Mick Jagger standing on the other side of the place. And you needed somebody in the middle to say, have you met this guy? And to say, this guy is a really interesting guy to talk to. And that was Tara. And that was the function Tara played in the 60s.
I mean, this book started out kind of originally as a Sunday Tribune article, right?
Yeah.
You know, and then it turned into like a long series. How many interviews did you do for this? And like, in terms of the people you interviewed, who produced the most color? Because I mean, like, you know, I was talking to you before we started about Hugo Williams in The Spectator was talking about meeting you and talking about his memories of Tara Brown. And like that quote at the start, he was a colorful guy. So, I mean, how many interviews did you do, Paul, and what color ones came out?
I interviewed over 100 people. It's about 110 people. And you know, given that Tara was only 21 when he died, you know, it was
he's 21 and he did, like, let's say he's married and he had two kids as well
and a divorce on the way at 21, you know, and so he was going through his life at breakneck speed, you know, and also in a literal sense as well, you know, in that he was a really very very reckless driver, and he'd met all these people and there was different pockets to his life, you know. So he had his Venice years, he had his Paris years. Una took him off to live in Paris in the late 1950s. Una married a man called Miguel Ferreras, who was a bisexual Spanish-American dress designer she met in New York. She went into a shop to buy a dress and she married him 4 weeks later in her suite at the Drake Hotel. So, you know, you kind of get an idea of the sort of reckless nature of these aristocrats. You know, they did things on a whim. And it made life more interesting in a lot of cases when they did things like that. So she took Tara off to live in Paris. And Tara at 14 years of age, 15 years of age, is a regular in all the jazz clubs in Paris. And he's hanging out with these debutante girls who are in finishing schools in Paris, and they're kind of 18 or 19, and they're being led around the city by this 15-year-old boy who looked like an angel. He looked like he'd fallen off the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. He has this blonde hair. And I have a photograph of Tara in a jazz club. And jazz clubs, by the way, were incredibly seedy. You know, we listen to jazz now and we think it's quite sophisticated. But Hugo Williams told me when he told his father he was interested in jazz, he said it was like I told him I was a heroin addict, because there was that link between heroin and jazz. Yeah. And it was a very, very disreputable thing to be interested in jazz. Years before it became disreputable to be interested in rock and roll, yeah, jazz was the first. And but Tara was in these clubs, Una absent, Miguel not there. Tara was the adult in this company, a 15-year-old boy, and he's sitting in these clubs, and I have a picture of him with a scotch in one hand and a cigarette in the other, listening to Bud Powell, as it happens, who's one of the greats of bebop jazz. So he was incredibly precocious. So there were people from his Paris life I interviewed, his Venice life, his London life. He moved to London on his own at 16 years of age, almost as if he knew something great was about to happen in swinging London. Mm. So there were sort of all these pockets of his life. So the people who were a part of his Paris life actually didn't know much about his swinging London life, that he was just moving from set to set. So altogether, I interviewed about 110 people, but some of them multiple times.
Right.
And probably the most interesting, I think, was Anita Pallenberg, for many, many reasons. But firstly, you know, mostly the legend of Anita Pallenberg, you know, who's this, you know, Rolling Stones, you know, you could call her a groupie, but I've seen her called a groupie, but I think she was much more than that. She was a muse,
yeah,
for all of the Stones. And, you know, she was Brian Jones's girlfriend, and then she was Keith Richards's wife. And she was extraordinary, and I was terrified meeting her. I was absolutely terrified. It took me 4 years to get her to agree to talk to me. And that involved, I went to London and I put notes in her door. I sent her cards. I knocked on her door. I kind of introduced myself to mutual friends and said, could you put a word in? And What swung it in the end, myself and Gareth were in Lugalaw one afternoon, and it was actually about 11 o'clock in the morning. Gareth said, perhaps if I rang her, Gareth hadn't seen her for about 35 years. And he said, perhaps if I rang her, it would help. So anyway, we went out to ring her, and there's a little scullery in Lugalaw, and there's a telephone in there. And we went into the scullery, and Gareth said, no, I've lost my nerve. Because she's quite a formidable woman, like, you know. And so Gareth lost his nerve. So we went back to the drawing room, and we had the best part of a bottle of champagne. And then we went back to the scullery and we phoned her, and we were a bit giddy, and she answered the phone, and she was just adorable, you know. And she said, oh, I ignored all of your letters and your cards because I didn't think the book had Gareth's imprimatur, but now that I know it does, when can you come to London? So I said, tomorrow. So I went to London, and I mean, I met her, and she lives in this apartment on that street. I can't remember the name. It's the street where Oscar Wilde lived. It's quite near the embankment, quite near the Thames. And her, you know, I interviewed her in her bedroom overlooking the Thames. And she was sitting on the edge of the bed, and I was just like this 16-year-old schoolboy sitting on this hard chair interviewing her like a gibbering mess I was, you know, because, you know, she was extraordinary. And
yeah,
what a beautiful woman. You right. know, she was amazing.
It sounds like it's not a lot better than those knee trembler interviews you used to do with football players back in the day.
The knee trembler. Yeah,
it's a great
yeah,
expression.
Yeah, we should probably explain what the knee trembler is. When you interview footballers, when I started out in sports journalism, it was possible to phone up the captain of the Irish football team or any footballer and say, can I have an interview? And they'd say, yeah, no problem at all. When do you want to come over? And you'd say, well, actually, Wednesday would really suit me. And they say, well, I'll pick you up at the airport, drive you to the house. You know, they cook you dinner, or their wife would cook you dinner, and you do 4 or 5 hour interview and then go back to the airport. And then when agents came in, football journalism completely changed. Sports journalism completely changed. So we would then get what we used to call the knee trembler in the car park. So you would go to you go to maybe to Birmingham to interview a footballer, and not necessarily a well-known footballer. You know, it could be somebody who's, you know, played 20 matches for the first team in a championship or first division team, and they would give, you know, you, so you'd meet them and you'd say, you sort of waved to them across the car park as they were getting into the Ferrari, and you'd say, oh, Paul Howard from the Tribune, I rang you, you said you'd give me an interview. Oh yeah, will this take long? Well, I've just got a few questions. All right. And so they'd lean up against the car, and after three questions they would always say, is there many more of these? And so that's why we always called it an e-trambler. Yeah. You know?
Do you miss that sports journalism days?
I don't miss those days. I mean, I don't miss the knee tremblers. Like, you know, they were my idea.
Because after you finish with knee trembler, you get a call in from the editor saying, well, how's it go? And you kind of obviously say, well, and he says, okay, give me 3,000 words.
Yeah, that always happened. I interviewed Clinton Morrison. And actually, Clinton Morrison was one of the best, you know. Clinton Morrison was a lovely guy, really personable, very funny. And I went to, I think he was at Crystal Palace at the time. So I went to London to interview him. And I met him at the club, and he didn't look at me once during a 25-minute interview. He was watching the television, and I was sitting here, and he was just watching. The television was on mute, and he was just like staring at this muted television. And so I interviewed him for about 25 minutes, and most of the answers he just went, yeah, sweet, sweet. And so in the end, I decided this is a waste of my time. And I kind of got up at 4 a.m. to get the flight to London. And then my flight home was at 10, because in a fit of optimism, I think, you know, I might get 8 hours with this guy and he could tell me his whole life story. So I realized I'm wasting my time here. So I got up to leave, and he just, without looking at me, put his hand up for the high five. And I sort of high fived him, and then I left. And then I got lost. I was locked into the club and I couldn't get out. And so I felt like an idiot walking around. And then I passed Clinton Morrison and I asked him the way out, and I knew he didn't know who I was. You know? I knew he didn't. 25 minutes. And then I rang the office and said 3,000 words. So there's a little bit of you thinks you're conning the public in telling them that you've actually met this guy and connected with him on a certain level. So I certainly don't miss that. That became really, really, to me, when I was a sports journalist, that became just a really, really annoying part of the job to have to do celebrity interviews.
Yeah.
Because while this is happening, sort of the age of the celebrity is taking off. Everybody wants celebrity. It was never a case of what do you have to write this week? It was, who can you get? What name can we get? And usually they were just giving you nothing. So it was kind of the start of that. I mean, there's still the celebrity journalism culture today where you interview somebody. I can read, you know, you can read 4,000 words about somebody in a magazine and still know absolutely nothing about them at the end. So there wasn't really any access anymore. So once there was no access, I was starting to lose interest in it anyway, you know. It was,
but like, I mean, that sort of access, I mean, you did a really interesting interview with kind of Paul Kimmich, the only wine snob in Coolock. He still is the only wine snob in Coolock. You're talking about access, and I thought it was quite interesting, because it's like, you know, it struck me that this idea of kind of getting that access and getting into the ear, getting into the minds of the subject is something that, like, I mean, all journalists try and do, you know, but you've got to kind of decide, are you going to compromise yourself in terms of, like, what you write then afterwards?
Yeah, you do have to. I mean, look, all of the... Most of my generation who became sports journalists, they became sports journalists because at a certain point in their life, they read some, you know, often American writers who wrote pieces that just blew them away. And for me, it was reading, you know, my dad bought me an anthology of boxing writing when I was about 16. And, you know, these writers like Gay Talese who go and spend, you know, a month with Floyd Patterson, who was the heavyweight champion of the world. And it was just two personalities who clicked. And Gay Talese actually became Floyd Patterson's confessor. So Patterson told Gay Talese, I've discovered I'm essentially a coward, while he was the heavyweight champion of the world, which is an extraordinary thing. And if the heavyweight champion of the world today, I don't even know who he is anymore, but I know there's about 10 of them. If he was of a mind to tell a journalist that he was a coward, 30 people would stop him. You know, there would be a PR person behind him going, wind this interview up now, you know. It just wouldn't happen anymore. So that era died. But, I mean, that's what drew me to journalism. It was the idea of actually being able to sit down and have a conversation with somebody. You can still do it in some sports. I always found that, you know, track and field and swimming, boxing, often the Olympic sports, rowers especially, and the Donovan brothers, I mean, they're extraordinary. But the Donovan brothers, if a PR company had got to them 5 years ago, they would be the dullest two guys you ever met in your life. But they haven't been PR'd.
Yeah.
And because they haven't been PR'd, everybody thinks these guys are a breath of fresh air. Well, when I started in journalism, everybody was like that.
Yeah.
You know, you could get people to actually talk honestly to you. But it stopped. And it just became a little bit dull. And now, I mean, I look at sports now and I think I don't know anybody in sports anymore. You know, I watch a Premier League match. I don't know anything about any of the players on the field. And I could read a million words about them and I still wouldn't connect with them in any way.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. I think they've lost their audience. That's one of the reasons they've lost their audience, because they don't connect to them anymore. We don't know anything about them as humans. They're all watching the muted television.
Yeah. Is there muted? Oh, there's yeah. I
just sort of coming out there. By the way, you're all missing great goals here on Sky Sports.
you mentioned three sports there, Paul. You mentioned kind of like, you know, that you're interested in. You kind of like said there was kind of swimming, track and field and boxing. There are three sports that have been riddled with kind of like being doping allegations over the while. I know that, like say, you were one of the people who kind of raised your hand over the kind of like the Tour de France from the start off here in 98. You were also kind of obviously the Michelle Smith thing in 96, the Atlanta thing. Do you think as well that that's something which has kind of severed the connection between the audience in the sports, the fact that we look at these sports sometimes and go, they're not clean?
I don't know. I mean, that's my experience. I don't believe in the sports. We were clearing out the attic recently and I found this Ladybird book that I had when I was probably 13 years of age. It was the Los Angeles Olympics and it had all the track and field, to fill in all the who won all the medals, and I was just trying to remember that might be the last time, innocent time in my life when I actually really did believe these things were real. I felt that a long, long time ago, probably about 20 years ago, so it's about 5 years into my journalism career, I realized this, what I'm seeing here isn't real. Me and Paul Kimmich were on a bus at the Sydney Olympics and there's a sort of bus takes you around from the venues to the Olympic Village and the media village and everything. And we were sitting down the back of the bus and this athlete got on, who's a well-known athlete, and he took off his top and his back was just covered in acne. And an acne, back acne especially, is a sure sign of steroid use in an athlete. And what really struck me about that was how unapologetic he was, you know, how unafraid he was to let everybody see that he had this thing that was essentially a giveaway sign that he was a steroid user. And there's all these other athletes on the bus. And I kind of thought, no one else is looking at him. No one else thinks that's relevant, you know. And me and Paul are at the back of the bus thinking, this is the most incredible thing we've ever seen. But it's not, you know, because they know. So I kind of fell out of love with it. But I don't know if it's the case with all sports fans. I mean, a good friend of mine who's a cycling fan and he's passionate about cycling, he laughs when people debate whether Lance Armstrong is on drugs or whether, you know, Chris Froome is on drugs or who is on drugs. He said real cycling fans laugh because real cycling fans don't care. This is what he said. I mean, I'm sure he's not talking for all cycling fans. Mm. He's certainly talking for him and probably a sizable constituency out there who just don't care, who think, I still think that, you know, cycling up the Alps on a bike, just a man on a bike, and no matter what he's got coursing through his veins, I still think that's an extraordinary athletic achievement. And so I suppose if you can kind of make that leap and make that compromise and say, yeah, I still respect that. I couldn't, you know.
Yeah.
And it's one of the reasons I quit sports journalism, you know. I just couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't go to an Olympics. I couldn't cover an Olympics now without libeling 200 athletes, you know. I mean, when I was in the Tribune, I was trouble for the lawyers, you know. I was the only sports journalist who's sitting down every Friday with Hugh Moen, the Tribune barrister, to try to say, I need to say this. And he's kind of saying, well, we need to find a way to say it without closing the newspaper down. And this just became every week. And I went to the Olympics in Athens in 2004 and I brought about 30 books with me, you know, sort of research books. And I think about 25 of them were about drugs. And that just, and then actually there were drugs, there were two drugs, Irish drug scandals at that Olympics, yeah. You know, there was, you know, there was the Cathal Lombard tested positive just before the Olympics for EPO. And then we had the Kian O'Connor's horse, Water for Crystal, yeah. We lost a gold medal.
Yeah.
So
and
suddenly.
And she's a great headline now, who took the piss?
Who took the piss? Yeah, 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 yeah. And the joke that, you know, the horse should have just said it was grass.
Yeah. But like, I mean, when things like that happen, though, it totally colours your perspective as a journalist then.
Yeah, because you kind of think, you know, you're onto the sports desk at home and they're saying, let's write a piece that, you know, you need to capture this. You need to capture the excitement of this. But at the same time, you're thinking, let's wait 6 weeks till the drug test comes in, yeah. You know, the yeah. result of the drug test. And that's unfortunately how I felt. And that's why I knew it was the right time to leave.
Yeah. And like, I mean, also the right time to leave because, I mean, you had Ross O'Carroll Kelly at that stage as well.
Yeah, I'd given birth to Ross O'Carroll Kelly by then after a difficult labour, yeah.
I mean, this like, no, the success and ongoing success of Ross O'Carroll Kelly is just incredible. I mean, this comes from you being a club reporter, right, on covering yeah. covering schools rugby in Leinster.
Yeah, I covered schools rugby as a sort of 17, 18-year-old reporter. And, you know, when you're cutting your teeth as a sports writer, one of the things they do is they send you to schools rugby matches because, you know, it's kind of...
Punishment.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. And also it's to see, can you file on time? If they ask you for two paragraphs, are you going to file two instead of 10 or 30 or whatever? Can you file to length? Can you file on time? And then if you can do that, they give you something big, like a League of Ireland football match or something, you know? So my first match, I went out to Skerries and Blackrock in Skerries. And it was... In those days, it used to take days to get to Skerries. Like, you know, the bus would just take... He set off from O'Connell Street, Abbey Street. And the bus stop was right outside the Independent. And it was actually the Irish Independent gave me the marking. They said, go to Skerries and go for this match. And the match was at 4. And I think it was in there at 11. And the guy said, you better leave now. And I went to... I didn't know anything about rugby. So I went to... There's a second-hand bookshop still there on Abbey Street called Chapters. Yeah. And I went in there, or Readers, I think it's called... And I bought a book called The Laws of Rugby. It wasn't The Rules of Rugby because they were drafted by lawyers, you know. So they were The Laws of Rugby. It was a really important sounding book. And I read it, you know, and that's where I learned the laws of rugby on the bus to Skerries. It took hours, you know. I always say it was the first bus I ever saw where they sold duty free. And I get to Skerries and it felt like I was in Dingle or something, you know. It was a seaside town and it felt really, really far away. And I covered this match and I remember I was told to do 4 paragraphs, you know. And I was 17 and I was just out of school. It was my first thing I'd ever done for a newspaper. And I was just in love with the idea of what I was doing, you know. So in those days, before mobile phones, this is the late 80s, and I had to go to the clubhouse and I rang up the, you know, and I had to reverse the charges to the Independent copy takers, reverse charge call, and they say, yes, we'll accept the call. And you get put through to the copy taker, and I'd four paragraphs, which didn't seem a lot. I condensed all of this incredible action into 4 paragraphs. And after the first paragraph, the copy taker said, are you sure they want all this? And I was just crushed, like, you know. So I read the rest of it just thinking she was bored. You know, I could hear her smoking in the background, bored out of her head. But it appeared in the paper, you know. But what came out of that was I had never seen anything like schools rugby before. I went to a school, we played soccer, and we had no connection with rugby. I grew up in a working class area, you know, council house, and rugby was just not on our radar at all. And when our school football team played, there might be 12 people and a dog would be there watching the match. And that was it. No one else would go. And I'd go to these rugby matches and there'd be like 3,000 people at this school, like guys, like 16, 17, yeah. They were a year younger than me. And they're heroes, you know. I just thought it was amazing. And people who had left school, you know, 30 years ago, they haven't really left school, you know. They're, you know, they're the Surgeon General or, you know, they're a senior counsel and they still go back to watch Clongos play and get beaten heavily by Blackrock or something, you know. And they get really irate about it and then they go back to the law library. And I just thought this was an amazing slice of Irish life. I thought it was extraordinary. I'd be looking at the crowd more than the pitch, you know. Yeah, yeah. I just thought what was happening, you know, these, you know, gangs of Mount Anvil girls. And it seemed to me very like the kind of American high school American football thing. You know, you had these incredibly fit guys, handsome guys, sometimes horrifically ugly guys, but they seem to, the girls seem to be just as much interested in them. And, you know, and then you had the cheerleaders who were the Mounties, you know, and they would just throw themselves at these guys, you know, and those guys were heroes among their peers, you know, they were absolute heroes. And it was amazing. I'd never seen anything like it. And I did think this is, and then the mothers, you know, the kind of Brown Thomas mothers in the crowd with the wearing baby seals, and then the dads used to be on the big the first mobiles, those ones. Do you remember those? You had to hold the bottom, the Nokia one, and I just thought this is amazing, you know. And I heard I tell the story about the guy. I mean, I never met him, but I probably owe him some money. the guy Ross is based on, I just heard this kid say to his dad, "I don't give a fuck how you think I played. Just crack open the wallet." And, you know? And that was kind of, that was the early days of the Celtic Tiger, you know? I thought, that's amazing. Like, if I said that to my dad, wasn't a violent man, but I'd be still orbiting the earth if I said that. If I said that to my father, I don't give a fuck what you think I played. But this attitude was creeping in. They had so much confidence, you know? Yeah. I was getting on the dart one day, and this dart pulls into the station, and I noticed the first four carriages are packed, like, you know, like this venue today, you know, everybody's shoulder to shoulder. And the last carriage is empty. And I, what's going on here? So I walk down to the last carriage and I go to get on. I press the button and the door is open and there's a guy in a blazer standing there, and he puts his hand on my chest and says, "Sorry, dude, this is a rock carriage." So this was kind of creeping in, you know, all this arrogance and obnoxiousness among young people, you know. Yeah. So Ross was kind of born out of that, really, you know. Yeah. I saw this and I thought, so I started this column in the Tribune, which originally began as a sort of two or three paragraphs every Sunday, and it was kind of January 1998, so it's not nearly 19 years ago, and it was the diary of a school's rugby player. And it was weird because it you know, it started to generate mail, and, you know, it was before email. So they started to get letters and people would ring up and say, "Oh, who's writing that? I think I know who's writing that." And one of the early suspects was Brian O'Driscoll, you know. Yeah. So Brian was in UCD, and I didn't even know who Brian O'Driscoll was, you know, at the time. But so because he was in UCD, and Ross happened to be in UCD on the same sports scholarship course at the exact same time. So people would ring and say, I don't want to give my name. Will you just tell me, is that Draco writing that?" And that's the first time I ever heard Draco. And then, you know, obviously Brian O'Driscoll became Brian O'Driscoll. And I thought it would be really interesting to have their lives diverge at UCD. I wasn't interested in writing about somebody who was a real rugby hero. I thought I would love to write about somebody who, he's at the same level as Brian O'Driscoll, and Brian goes like that and this guy just goes down, you know. And the postscript to the story is, Brian said to me, I met Brian about 4 or 5 years ago, and he just said to me, "Do you know how many people buy me your books every Christmas thinking they're the first ones to see the similarity between them?"
That's great. We could talk for hours and hours. You said at the start, basically, you talk a lot, but that's been a fascinating 45 minutes. So that's great. From Tara Brown to Russell Carroll Kelly, go on and buy the books at Christmas. Paul Howard, thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thanks. Thanks very much. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a million to Paul for joining us in Dingle, and thanks to Banter at Other Voices producer Molly King, and Salman, Stephen Antricotti, and all at Foxy Johns and Other Voices for the hospitality and help. The Bantercast series producer is Tanya White. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news we're up to at Banter, plus you can also listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week with another podcast. On then, good luck and take care.